Welcome to this week's Talking History. This is Brian Lebeau of Creighton University's Department of History, your host for today's program. In a few minutes, as the principal segment of our show, Dennis Mihalik will be speaking with Professor Matthew Hoyos on Theodore Roosevelt's charge up San Juan Hill 100 years ago. But before we do that, let's look back at this week, June 22nd through the 28th, in history. On June 22, 1946, the Postal Service began using jet planes to transport the mail. On June 23, 1868, a clunky prelude to the modern typewriter was patented by Christopher L. Scholes of Wisconsin. On June 25, 1950, the Army of Communist North Korea invaded the South, triggering 3 years of warfare that would involve a U.S.-dominated United Nations force. And on June 28, 1894, Congress proclaimed Labor Day a federal holiday in honor of the working class. For this week's History in the News segment, we turn once again to Time Magazine. Their June 8th issue and its list of the 20 most influential artists and entertainers of the 20th century. It's the second of 5 lists of most influential people Time will be publishing over the next 2 years. We reported on the first list of political leaders and revolutionaries in an earlier show. In describing those included in its list of most influential artists and entertainers, Time's editor-in-chief Norman Perlstein writes that they, quote, beguiled us, touched us, and stirred us. They remade their worlds and taught us to see our own afresh. And indeed they have. Here then are Time's 20 most influential artists and entertainers of the 20th century. The artist Pablo Picasso, architect Le Corbusier, clothing designer Coco Chanel, the writer James Joyce, poet T.S. Eliot, Charlie Chaplin, of course, filmmaker Steven Spielberg, Marlon Brando, classical musician Igor Stravinsky, the Beatles, Bob Dylan, soul musician Aretha Franklin, jazz musician Louis Armstrong, Frank Sinatra, showman Rodgers and Hammerstein, I Love Lucille Lobal, TV creator Jim Henson, TV host Oprah Winfrey, dancer Martha Graham, and number 20, if you're ready for this, cartoon character Bart Simpson. Once again, that was Time Magazine's list of the 20 most influential artists and entertainers of the 20th century. You're listening to Talking History. Welcome back. Listed among Time Magazine's most influential political leaders of the 20th century was Theodore Roosevelt. And this year we mark the centennial of the event that first called Roosevelt to the public's attention, his charge up San Juan Hill. To help us better understand that event is Creighton historian Dennis Mihalik. Dennis?
Thank you, Brian. 100 years ago, the United States fought a brief but significant war against Spain. One of the most ballyhooed episodes of the Spanish-American War was the July 1st, 1898, so-called charge of Theodore Roosevelt and the Rough Riders of San Juan Hill in Cuba. Here to put the man and the events in perspective is our guest today, Dr. Matthew Hoyos, currently an assistant professor of history at Radford University at Radford, Virginia. He is the author of several articles on military history. He has contributed to the introduction to the reprint of Theodore Roosevelt's book, The Rough Riders, forthcoming from Bison Books of the University of Nebraska Press. And he is currently completing a book entitled Theodore Roosevelt, Commander-in-Chief, which will be forthcoming from the University of North Carolina Press. Welcome, Dr. Hoyos.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
Would you briefly explain to us the origins of the Spanish-American War?
Yes, the war actually has its origins in one of the periodic revolts the Cuban people had made against the rule of Spain. Cuba remained essentially the last jewel in the crown of the old Spanish American Empire that once covered much of Southern America. There had been some previous revolts. In 1868, there had been a revolt in Cuba that had been successfully squashed. In 1895, though, a new revolt broke out, And the Spanish attempts to squash that revolt struck Americans as being particularly brutal. Spanish were using kind of classic anti-guerrilla tactics to separate away the Spanish, or I should say the Cuban people, away from the insurgent guerrillas, essentially putting them into concentration camps. And a lot of Americans viewed these events and said that the United States has the power and has the moral obligation to intervene and really kind of end what they regarded as a degraded Spanish rule in the Americas. Another factor, though, that really should be weighed in the balance of why the United States intervenes in this war, and why it had intervened in Cuba in the past during past revolts, is that the country was profoundly different in the 1890s than it had been in the past. The country had, of course, gone through the bulk of industrialization by this point in time. It had a lot of power, a lot of economic muscle. And a lot of people thought that the United States should start exercising those muscles, and a good place to start seemed to be in Cuba. And on top of that, a lot of other Americans were looking around and feeling that with the end of the frontier, it was proclaimed to be at an end in 1890, that if a country didn't manage to keep expanding itself in one way or another, it eventually would grow soft and weak and ultimately become the victim of other countries, somewhat the social Darwinistic thinking of that point in time. That is, unless a country, to put it in Theodore Roosevelt's own words, participated in the struggles and strife of the world, that country's people would lose their hardihood, those kind of frontier values that had built the United States in the first place. So that was a factor that was particularly strong in the 1890s. And help bring about the American intervention in Cuba then in the spring of 1898.
Mm-hmm. So then following the sinking of the Maine, the battleship Maine, the United States believed that that Spain was involved in that sinking, and then the United States Congress decided to intervene.
Yes, that's pretty much it. Now, the captain of the Maine at the time, a fellow by the name of Charles Sigsbee, said, don't rush to any conclusions about what caused this explosion of my particular battleship. He wasn't convinced it was a Spanish mine, or possibly the work of some of the Cuban insurgents trying to provoke American intervention. But of course, the famed yellow press of the Hearst and Pulitzer papers with their publication competition going on in New York were particularly instrumental in helping give this kind of rush to war, this public pressure that William McKinley, the president at the time, just simply could not resist. And he tried. He really tried. He did not want a war. The Spanish minister at the time did not want a war. McKinley said that something has to be done to rectify the Cuban situation, that what you need to do is give the Cubans their independence. The Spanish were not willing to do that. They were only willing to go for home rule. And in the end, April 1898, McKinley goes back into a corner, and he's got to ask for that declaration of war.
Mm-hmm. And it was granted. Now, the war only lasted about 6 months, but nonetheless, it did have some very important significances, long-term even, in American history.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Could you explain those to us briefly?
Yeah, absolutely. The war itself, in terms of the fighting, really only lasts 3 months, too, to really kind of encapsulate how it does have this profound impact for actually very little time spent in conflict itself. The bottom line, I would say, is that the war marks the entrance of the U.S. into the world of the great powers. Now, the U.S., by 1898, was already a great power in form and in substance. I mean, it was an economic great power. But it had not yet truly assumed kind of the international responsibilities that were seen as part and parcel of being a great power in that day and age, of course being of the rank of, say, a Great Britain or France or Russia and so forth. And, of course, one of the signs of being a great power was undertaking some kind of colonial responsibilities, which was a mantle the United States then began to wear after the war, particularly in overseeing Cuba as one of its protectorates, acquiring Puerto Rico, and then most notably in the Pacific, taking on the Philippines as an out-and-out American colony. In other words, the war is really kind of America's entree into the realm of acting full-blown as a great power. And that process didn't stop there. Of course, it continues on even down today in terms of America's involvement in the world. Of course, those involvements go far beyond anything that the people of 1898 ever envisioned. But, you know, the real process starts with this war. So, yeah, it really does have profound consequences for the country.
Okay. Now, as you said, there actually wasn't a lot of fighting in the war. But in terms of the fighting that did take place, and especially that on the island of Cuba, a group named the Rough Riders became instantly famous. Could you discuss their composition, their significance?
Sure. Well, actually, before they ended up in Cuba, as part of the expedition sent down there to confront the Spanish forces head-on, they were already famous. They actually, to trace their origins, I mean, are part and parcel of a hallowed American military tradition. That is the volunteer citizen soldier. Historically, the American armed forces, up to this point in time, in peacetime, were minuscule. The army, pretty much during much of the 19th century in peacetime, was around 25,000 individuals, a very small force by today's standards. And so when you had a wartime emergency, you had to flesh that force out very quickly. And one of the expedients for doing that was recruiting federal volunteers. And the Rough Riders are part of that tradition. Essentially, officers are designated through commissions. And typically in that day and age, to raise a volunteer unit, you received a commission as an officer if you had some kind of political connections. And that's very true in the case of the Rough Riders. For instance, the actual commander of the unit at first is not Theodore Roosevelt. He wisely decides that he does not have the experience yet to organize such a unit. So he defers to his good friend Leonard Wood, who had military experience. He had originally been a contract surgeon in the Army and had helped hunt down Geronimo in the 1880s. Wood was, in 1898, the personal physician to President McKinley and his wife, Ida. So he had some of the best possible political connections you could hope for. And, of course, Roosevelt had moved through New York political circles up to this point in his life. He had Washington connections, and he was Assistant Secretary of the Navy at the time. So he had good connections as well. Once these fellows received their commission to raise a volunteer regiment, they make this regiment special, so that it attracts a lot of public attention. For Roosevelt, it was kind of a quintessentially American unit. He wants to bring in the Southwesterners, kind of the cowboy types, and per se, the Rough Riders, which was another name for cowboys in that day and age, and something Roosevelt was fond of quoting when he'd actually had a ranch out in Dakota Territory in the 1880s. And to marry these fellows with actually the other influence in Roosevelt's life, and also in Wood's life, too, kind of athletic Ivy Leaguers. And for Roosevelt, this marriage of kind of the old frontier type with maybe the new type of individual who he sees kind of carrying forth American hardihood into the 20th century is kind of the perfect combination. And so there's a lot of publicity surrounding the raising of this particular regiment, which by the way, was officially known as the 1st United States Volunteer Cavalry. The Rough Riders is simply a nickname for it. And, of course, they just get droves of applications to join the unit.
Okay. Now, what were the numbers then that made the charge up San Juan Hill? Are we talking about hundreds or thousands?
Well, generally, the official size of regiments in those days is around 1,000, but effective strength is usually something lower. So you're talking, yes, in terms of hundreds, actually. Especially by the point of the Santiago campaign, of which they are a part, they've already taken some casualties in a prior battle that they fought on the way to that battle site. And, of course, they're fighting in the tropics in the 1890s in a rather undeveloped area, and there's a lot of tropical diseases that are rendering a lot of men incapable of fighting as well. And that is going to prove very debilitating as well throughout the campaign. More men are affected by disease, in fact, than are ever shot down by Spanish bullets during the campaign.
Mm-hmm. So then what did the charge of San Juan Hill actually consist of, that is, in terms of military fighting?
Mm-hmm. Well, the charge itself, the aim of it is, of course, to take Santiago de Cuba, the site where the Eastern Squadron of the Spanish Navy had located itself. So that's their ultimate objective. And to achieve that objective, they want to take the heights around the city. If you can put cannon on those heights, you can make the Spanish position in that city unsustainable. And so then the tactical aspects of the charge are, they're actually fairly primitive in terms of the tactics, because, you know, these are volunteer soldiers, so you're not going to try anything elaborate. And they're essentially going to undertake what would truly be a more kind of deliberate, determined walk up the hill. You get romanticized images of them kind of rushing pell-mell up these hills.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to attack two sites, actually.
Right.
One's called Kettle Hill, and then they actually move on up to the southern slope of San Juan Hill. They're all part of the San Juan Heights, though.
Right, and so even though they're cavalry and they're the Rough Riders, they're walking up the hill?
Oh, yes, yes, because they actually don't have their horses, with the exception of Roosevelt. They're dismounted.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of snafus involved with this expedition in getting it over from Florida, which was their point of departure, over to Cuba. There's not enough transport. It's a very disorganized venture. And so the bottom line is only the officers get to have their horses. And so these fellows are essentially foot troops.
Mm-hmm.
When they make the charge, Roosevelt is the only one out on horseback. And he doesn't go to the top on horseback either. He is in a very exposed position when he does this on horseback. I mean, he's towering above his men because of his position. But he doesn't get shot down. He's not wounded at all in the battle. When he runs into some obstacles near the top of Kettle Hill, he is forced to dismount, and then he's one of the first near the top. It's really only in those last few yards that you get that kind of pell-mell rush. But by then, the Spanish are already abandoning the position. The Rough Riders benefited from the fact that the Spaniards hadn't focused a lot of their troops on defending the San Juan Heights.
Mm-hmm.
And that was fortunate, because it was tough enough rushing this position. The Spanish fire was very heavy. They took a fair number of casualties.
Mm-hmm.
It was a tough proposition.
I see. So then, after the battle, Roosevelt wrote a book, The Rough Riders.
Mm-hmm.
And a centennial re-edition is coming out. In the 30 seconds that we have left, could you tell our listeners the most significant parts of the book that they should pay attention to?
Yeah, well, I guess I would approach the book as a very good window on the past. It's a window on looking at how America fought its wars throughout much of the 19th century. This is the last one in which you're going to have these kind of volunteer officers raising these units. Look for also how Roosevelt celebrates his men. He wants to celebrate them as kind of ultimate expressions of American manhood in that day and age. And also look, too, at how he critiques the expedition. It's not a full-scale celebration of what the Army did in Cuba. He's very forthcoming about many of the flaws that occurred in the Cuban expedition. I would say, though, it's a good piece of history. And to keep in mind as one's reading it, that Roosevelt is also a historian by trade. He's an accomplished writer by this point in his life.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, thank you very much. That's all the time we have. We've been talking with Dr. Matthew Hoyos of Radford University about Theodore Roosevelt, the Rough Riders, and the Charge of San Juan Hill that occurred a century ago on July 1st, 1898.
For this week's radio op-ed piece, we continue on the subject of Theodore Roosevelt's march up San Juan Hill, or Heights if you prefer. Providing his historical perspective on that event is Frank Schubert, historian in the History Office of the Joint Chiefs of Staff at the Pentagon. The title of Dr. Schubert's piece is Finding the Middle, Who Should Get the Credit for the Victory at San Juan Heights, Cuba in 1898.
Finding the middle, where the truth sometimes rests, requires you to know the edges. When it comes to the fights between the armies of the United States and Spain on San Juan Heights, Cuba on July 1, 1898, the edges are easy to find. On the one side, there's what I call the Teddy-centric view, first and most clearly expressed in the writings of Lieutenant Colonel Theodore Roosevelt of the 1st Volunteer Cavalry Regiment, the legendary Rough Riders. Roosevelt's memoir of the fight so emphasized his own role that Mr. Dooley, the barroom pundit created by humorist Peter Finley Dunne, said the book should have been called Alone in Cuba. Roosevelt augmented his campaign of self-promotion by carrying along his personal publicist. Richard Harding Davis's dispatches from the front, picked up by many newspapers and magazines, spread the word of T.R.'s heroics. They also followed a time-honored tradition. George Custer had taken a reporter on the 1874 expedition that discovered gold in the Black Hills, and Nelson Miles had carried one along to record his exploits against the tribes of the Southern Plains. Now Davis of the New York Herald did the same for T.R. The view that Davis spread, that Teddy Roosevelt dominated the Battle of San Juan Heights, still has adherents. I saw evidence of this last February when I made a presentation for African American History Month at Oyster Bay, New York, the great man's home. The draft press release, which announced that I would be talking about Medal of Honor heroes among Buffalo soldiers, the black regulars who had served on the frontier and who also fought in Cuba, asserted that these soldiers had assisted T.R. in achieving victory at San Juan Hill. Clearly, the text implied that the 3,000 black troopers dodging bullets and pushing their way resolutely forward in the Cuban sun were supporting players. T.R. still got top billing. Lately, a competing view has emerged to challenge Teddy-centric claims. This new assertion puts the Buffalo soldiers at the center of the Cuban fighting, relegating Roosevelt to a supporting role. Most recently, this view was stated by Edward Van Zyl Scott in his book, The Unwept, Black American Soldiers and the Spanish-American War. According to Scott, quote, in the Spanish-American War of 1898, veteran black troops were more responsible than any other group for the United States victory, end quote. The new interpretation substitutes one extreme position represented by the emphasis on TR with another, focusing on the contributions of African-American soldiers. These competing viewpoints represent the edges, but don't help us understand what happened on the battlefield. For that, we have to go toward the middle. About 15,000 American troops participated in the battles on July 1, and more than 200 of them were killed in action. Some of these soldiers were regulars, others were volunteers. About 3,000 were black, and about 12,000 were white. They fought side by side, endured the same blistering heat and driving rain, and shared food and drink as well as peril and discomfort. They forged a victory that did not belong primarily to TR, nor did it belong mainly to the Buffalo soldiers. It belonged to all of them.
You've been listening to Frank Schubert, historian in the History Office of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Time for our list of coming attractions, upcoming films, television programs, museum exhibits, or anything else that may be of interest to our listeners. First, watch the Sistine Chapel get a facelift on PBS this Wednesday, June 24th. A documentary titled Michelangelo Restored explores 13 years of restoration efforts on the Sistine Chapel and the cleaning of Michelangelo's frescoes. The documentary also studies Michelangelo the man, his struggles, and his genius. Check your local listings for more information. The History Channel will discuss the creation of a monster in Thursdays, this is June 25th, Frankenstein. The one-hour program explores the 18th century scientific experimentation that may have inspired Mary Shelley's classic novel. And next Monday, June 29th, PBS will provide viewers with a tour of what could be the world's oldest mausoleum in Egypt's City of the Dead. The program explores archaeologists' attempts to study the site as much as possible before highway construction rips through the region. And once again, check your local listings for more information. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed our show. We welcome your comments or suggestions as to anything you'd like us to deal with on this program. Send them to us either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by regular mail at Talking History, care of the Department of History at Creighton University, Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. We look forward to hearing from you. Until next time, from Creighton University, this is Brian LeBeau.